WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Linda Kenyon. Consumers spent a record $10.8 billion in e-commerce Black Friday. Vivek Pandya is with Adobe Lead Insights.
We see consumers being quite price sensitive and price conscious, but also them being in a relatively better position financially than they were a couple of years ago when inflation was first surging. So that puts them in a position to spend a bit more freely on goods.
The first major snowstorm of the year is hitting West Michigan hard. CBS News Detroit meteorologist Ahmed Baji has details.
Watch for more cold air widespread. Only Macomb County gets a chance to really try and get to 30 until you get to Port Huron and you're just closer to the water. But even then, that cold is going to stick because all the way through next week, Wednesday will be our next round of snow, enough to likely give us a couple more inches of snowfall.
Meanwhile, an Arctic air mass is bringing the coolest air since last winter to the plains and Midwest and into the South and the East Coast. World Central Kitchen says it is pausing operations in Gaza after an Israeli drone strike killed three of its employees. The Israeli military says it was targeting a militant who took part in the October 7th attack. The BBC's Nick Beek has more.
Images from Han Yunis show the wreckage of a white vehicle with its roof blown open. Video filmed inside a mortuary revealed charred possessions, apparently taken from the mangled car, that included a laptop, clothing, and an ID badge, all bearing the charity's logo.
World Central Kitchen released a statement saying it had no knowledge that any individual in the vehicle had any ties to terrorism. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau met with President-elect Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago yesterday to discuss Trump's plans to impose sweeping tariffs on Canada and Mexico. CBS's Weijia Jiang has details.
Both North American allies are weighing retaliatory tariffs on U.S. products. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum spoke by phone with Trump on Wednesday, but she said the issue did not come up.
Trudeau told Canadian media that the threatened tariffs could lead to higher prices, especially for Americans, and could lead to massive economic consequences. The world got a sneak peek of the rebuilt interior of the iconic Notre Dame Cathedral yesterday. The remarkable restoration was unveiled in Paris, France.
It was broadcast live during French President Emmanuel Macron's tour through the sanctuary. A fire gutted the landmark more than 5 years ago. From the stunning stonework to the soaring ceilings, more than 500 people worked on the monumental reconstruction project.
That's CBS Saturday Morning's Dana Jacobson. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Groups fighting to improve access to health care are asking the U.S. Senate to reject Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Suzanne Potter reports.
RFK Jr. is an environmental lawyer who ran for president and then threw his support to Donald Trump in August. Matthew Herdman, California State Director with the nonprofit Protect Our Care, says RFK Jr. has falsely linked vaccines to autism.
When he went to American Samoa to talk about vaccine safety there, almost immediately afterwards, there was a large measles outbreak that led to 83 Americans losing their lives. I would be terrified to see that happen, spread nationwide across our country.
RFK Jr. has said one of his priorities would be to re-examine pesticides that are legal in the U.S. but are banned or being phased out in Europe. He has also promoted raw milk, despite warnings from the FDA and CDC that unpasteurized milk can carry salmonella, E. coli, listeria, and the virus that causes bird flu. Dr. Diana Dayal is an emergency room resident physician at UCLA and a union representative who says she's troubled by RFK Jr.'s beliefs.
He has touted countless baseless claims time and time again that have later been contradicted by expert review. From his takes on vaccine development to fluoride safety, he misrepresents isolated data as conclusive and then interprets other studies incorrectly. Conveniently, he then ignores vast scientific evidence and peer review that runs counter to his beliefs.
Chris Noble with Health Access California notes that RFK Jr. once called the COVID-19 vaccine the deadliest vaccine ever made.
RFK Jr. will continue to propagate medical conspiracies that further erode trust in evidence-based medicine that will result in preventable death and grave threats to public health if given a seat of power.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and a high near 16. Wind chills at 5 to 10 below zero, with a northwest wind that could gust up to 15 miles per hour. For tonight, partly cloudy, low around 9. Partly sunny for Sunday, 24. Mostly cloudy Monday, 24.
Currently, 13 degrees.
Dom Selvia.
Just PS, Dom's producer here. Next time, Dom will be back live for all the political talk you missed. No more looking at how the sausage gets made, except for the government. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hi, this is Scott Klug, and this is a special edition of our podcast, Lost in the Middle. Well, with the election behind us, my reporting on the lost political middle is going to taper off a bit. But before Washington turns to battles over cabinet selections and wonkish policy debates, pretty boring from my perspective, I joined forces with two other political podcast buddies to give the election our own twisted postmortem. Justin Young's a professional comedian and the host of a podcast, Politics, Politics, Politics. Justin's loved politics since the year 2000, when he watched his high school teacher in Florida count pieces of ripped paper to determine who would be the leader of the free world, only in America. If you want to gear up for the 28 election, he has a wildly successful card game called The Contender to prep for the next presidential debate. Meanwhile, our Lost in the Middle guest, Andrew Heaton, is the driving force behind his show, The Political Orphanage. He's an independent with libertarian instincts, and we are a tiny echo chamber of two. He's the best-selling author of Laughter is Better Than Communism, as well as two very funny novels. He once opened up for famous actor William Shatner, who said, "He's very, very funny." So there. He hosted our discussion, and sadly, we'll find that Justin had to bow out after the first half hour. Here's our conversation.
I'm Andrew Heaton, and I host The Political Orphanage. I am joined today by Justin Robert Young, good friend of mine and host of Politics, 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 as well as host of We're Not Wrong, a show in which I am a regular pundit. And we are joined by Scott Klug. Scott is me from the future. He's much more successful than me, a little bit more handsome, slightly less funny, but has an eerie similarity in his politics, which continues to baffle me. Hello, Scott. Good to see you.
Yeah, good afternoon, guys.
Yeah, and Heaton, you're not a regular pundit, Scott, on We're Not Wrong. You're a co-host. It's your show, too.
Thank you. That is what I meant to say. My brain is so scattered right now, Justin. Please don't read into that. I can never keep host and co-host straight. I can never remember what the proper designation is. Scott, you had initially wanted to convene our minds to discuss the election breakdown, and so I'm going to kick it to you. What do you think happened? What is your read on the election?
Well, a couple of sort of notes from 20,000 feet, and I'll let you guys jump in. You know, until this election, there was only one U.S. senator, Lonely Susan Collins, tucked up there in Maine, who got elected as a senator of one party while the president of another party, Joe Biden, won her reelection in 2020. This time out, there's a wide swath of them. So in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in it looks like Arizona and Nevada, it doesn't happen very often. If you talk to political scientists, lots of times they sort of laugh at ticket splitting as like this old quaint custom from the 1950s. But if you back up 2 years now in 2022, it happened all over the place. It happened in Georgia with a Republican governor, a Democratic senator. It happened in Maine with a Republican, in Vermont with a Republican governor, a Democratic senator. It happened in Kansas, for God's sakes. And it happens in Wisconsin because it always happens in Wisconsin. But I thought that was the real interesting takeaways from the election, just because I think all of us were trying to guess what would happen. I think the consensus and my guess was the Republicans would win the Senate. It looks like they're going to hold the House, which is a surprise to me. And I think Trump was a jump ball from the beginning. It was really hard. But I thought when I saw her lose North Carolina as badly as she did, that the Harris campaign was going to be in for a long night.
Yeah, I would say probably even if you wanted to get really degenerate with it, like I was, it was Duval County in Florida. As soon as you saw Duval County, which is Jacksonville, which actually had a big special election that a Democrat won in an off year, that was a gigantic sign that this was looking more like the Florida from 2022, which unfortunately for the Republicans did not precipitate a red wave. But if Duval's flipping like that, then that means that Georgia was probably flipping. And if Georgia was probably flipping, then that meant for sure North Carolina was flipping, because that is a little bit more red than Georgia. I think my biggest takeaway is Donald Trump's popular. And that's probably the biggest thing. It sounds stupid to say it now, but the Democrats didn't run a campaign that was indicative of them running against a popular candidate. They ran a campaign that was indicative of them running against somebody that everybody knew was really awful. They just needed it explained to them one more time. Where all those ticket splitters that Scott pointed out, all of them in the final months were running, "We worked with President Trump to bring jobs back to Michigan or back to Wisconsin." Ruben Gallego, you know, was brought in because Kyrsten Sinema wasn't progressive enough, that she was defending the filibuster and standing in the way of true progress. So the Democrats effectively chased out somebody who was an incumbent that would have gotten reelected with probably $0 put to her if she was running against Carrie Lake. Instead, they put in a progressive who then has to pretend that he's a border hawk, and Chuck Schumer has to spend tens of millions of dollars to convince the public of Arizona to do it. And we still, at least as we are talking right now, don't have an AP call. Ruben Gallego will be that senator. But still, mathematically, right now, on Monday, Senator Carrie Lake is in play. That wouldn't have been the case if Kyrsten Sinema were still there.
Yeah. I'm curious to both of you, what are your takeaways for the Democrats? And Scott, would you consider yourself a never-Trumper or a Republican in exile? Is there some label that you care to hoist a banner on?
Well, I would say philosophically, I'm a libertarian Republican. I'm not a fan of the government. I wish more of it would go away. I'm moderate on social issues, so I'm sort of a never Trump guy. Never voted for him, likely never will if he tries to run for a third time, which could be an interesting story. but I think that don't rule it out. The lesson for the Democrats, I think, is I buy into the theory that they really got clobbered by the woke stuff and by the economy. I think if you're a construction worker in Michigan, where they're trying to ban electrical vehicles, which is the company you work for or the companies who your company does business with, and then sort of wrapped around all of this sort of smug righteousness, I think that's what cost them the election. And it's, I thought it was hysterical that there was a panic at the Washington Post because they didn't issue their editorial and that Bezos intervened. Now, it would have been a story, I think, had Bezos said endorse Trump, but he didn't. He just said, "We're not going to do this." And the Post went apoplectic. They've never endorsed a Republican. And trust me, nobody in battleground Wisconsin was waking up one morning, "Oh my God," thinking, "What will the Washington Post do?" And I think that's the same problem the Democrats had.
Well, no, that's true, Scott, because they were all waiting for Taylor Swift's event with Kamala Harris, which has been something that has gotten, she only endorsed. It was only an Instagram thing. She didn't show up at the Eras Tour, and that's that has brought fascism to America.
I believe it is mostly economic that happened. I think that there's a touch of the wokeness, but I think it's overplayed. There was an advertisement that was running in battleground states.
You're in show business. Of course you think it's not played up enough.
the ad that I saw that I actually thought was a brilliant ad, it went Kamala Harris cares about they, them, Donald Trump cares about you, which I thought was actually a brilliant ad highlighting there's this sort of abstract borderline theological phenomenon going on that the Democrats are paying attention to. This guy cares about the price of butter. I think that was a very smart play. I do think it was mostly economic, and that I've basically had two different polling groups within the Heaton chicken shit index that I've used to tabulate where I thought the election was going to go. And that includes people who work in media and politics and people who don't work in media and politics. And so within the Trumposphere of people that voted for Trump, I'm going to discount people that work in media and politics, as I do not think that we or they are really emblematic of the overall population. So when I spoke to just people in Oklahoma, people in Texas, Uber drivers, folks at various events I would go to, it almost all variations of why are you voting for Trump were basically eggs cost a lot and I feel Democrats are mean to me. That was pretty much it. That was the takeaway that I had repeatedly. And what I find interesting about this is it seems to me that about half the Democrats are aware of this in all of the interactions that I've had and in the online publications that I'm reading. About half are going, look, we really have to figure out a way to meet people in the middle, in the bell curve distribution of what they care about, which appears to be bread and butter issues. And the other half is going, oh, hamburgers cost a lot, so fascism, well done. And I'm going, oh my God, you've learned nothing. You've learned absolutely nothing.
Well, and I think, you know, if you look at the demographic split, I mean, I think it's pretty interesting as the Democratic base, to a large degree, aside from Black women, who are still the most loyal coalition of anyone, it's largely, you could argue, affluent, suburban, and city voters, the city voters who live in 48-story condo buildings, not the city builders who, city dwellers like my son in L.A., who lives in a studio apartment which is smaller than the Gemini space capsule floating through space right now. But I think that for them, it didn't make a difference, right? I think they find it hard to believe that there are families somewhere who say, we can't go to Disney this year, and we can only go to McDonald's once a week, not twice a week. I mean, it's real arithmetic if you don't make very much money. And I think especially for a lot of folks who worked in construction, and I know you can put up all the fancy economic indicators and all of that, but for them, when they looked in their wallet, it was a different experience than it was 8 years ago.
And I would say even further than that, Scott, that it's not just a different experience. It's a ritual humiliation. And you wonder why the inflation has a historical legacy that was reaffirmed last Tuesday of killing presidencies dead. It's exactly that. If you have the same job that you had, and so let's say, you know, unemployment has been where it's at, which has not, you know, significantly risen. And so that was something that people pointed at. But that's even worse in certain cases, because let's say you got the same job and you make under $100,000 and all of a sudden you're poorer. You didn't do anything different. Everything stayed exactly the same. You were still working the same hours that you were working. You're just older and poorer, and you blame somebody for that. That is just simply how it happens. And there really, really was a disconnect in my life, which is largely either, you know, a bunch of upper middle class millennials who are at the peak of our vibrancy and earning potential and, you know, driving around in our Teslas saying, I don't know, I think the economy's good. Because for us, inflation is every once in a while coming out of the Whole Foods and saying, gee, that's a high number. Like, it's not something that is every time you go and you have to look at your kids in the face and say, no, we're getting the bag of cereal as opposed to the Lucky Charms. And now I have to deal with a screaming toddler because they don't know the difference of what, you know, a broken supply chain is. And then it doesn't bring you any comfort when the White House continually gaslit America throughout this and continually said,
name,
well, this is just
one
transitory.
Time other than economics or the senility of the president, other than, I mean, those, yeah, two factors, name one time.
And look, you can lie about the president not having his marbles. Reagan got away with it mostly, but you can as long as the economy's good, everybody's got to feel good about the economy. They got to feel good about how things are going. And they weren't. It was transitory. Then it was Putin's price hike. And then eventually the only thing that they ever acknowledged it was to say, well, it's coming down now. You know, it's doing pretty good now. There was never pain.
They would say inflation's going down, by which they mean the rate of inflation is going,
yeah,
down. That's not the same thing as inflation. So it's gone. Inflation's increased by 10% over the last year and a half. Your money's gone. It's gone. It's not coming back. It's not that the prices are going to go back down. It's that the rate of acceleration is slowing down,
yes,
which is a meaningful distinction for people. Like, I'm a semi-successful comedian. I've had to work very hard to save what little money I have. And I am the Warren Buffett of comedians, given that I have any savings at all. And watching, you know, 10% of that just evaporate was like, oh, well, that's fun.
Yeah, that's it continued. I want to flip it on the other side, though. Scott, I'm descended from Barry Goldwater Republicans, and that's the household in which I was raised. The Never Trumpers, Republicans in exile, whatever we want to call them, that I have met have either reconciled to Trump and gone, you know, maybe I overplayed this and he's rough, but I can get behind him. Or alternately, they are sitting Shiva for the party and the death of the party. I think at this point, it's difficult to say that Trump is a transitory blip and that we will go back to Mitt Romney, you know, Mitt Romney Jr. 4 years from now. Do you re-register as a Democrat? Do you restart the Whig Party? What do you do?
Well, so I think he's a unique figure, right? This is, if you're sitting in central Minnesota trying to figure out how the hell did Jesse Ventura get elected as a professional wrestler. And I think that's part of what will happen. It will return to normalcy. But I think whatever happens 4 years from now, whoever the Republican nominee is, the morning they wake up, it's not the party that elected George W. Bush. It's not the party that, well, didn't vote particularly well for Ryan and for Romney when they ran. It's much more blue collar. It's much more rural. I think in many ways it's much more evangelical than it was, which is a strange phrase to use in concert with Donald Trump's personal habits. I don't think you're going to be able to go back. I don't know that those suburbs will flip. And I think the danger for the Republicans, if they go, oh, well, we got to recapture the wow counties around Milwaukee, which is the Republican base for the last 20 years, which largely drifted away from national Republican politics because of Trump. I think for every vote you pick up in the suburbs, if you don't handle this well, you're going to lose 3 votes in the small towns. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how the parties recalibrate, right? Because the Republicans will have to react to whatever the Democrats do and vice versa. And they're going to have to react to the way the economy is. And Justin's absolutely right. I mean, 2 years from now, if the economy is soaring, the Republicans will add seats in the Senate and continue to hold on to the House. And if we have a huge burp, as Trump puts, you know, tariffs on things, tariffs are just a hidden tax on people, right? And so the idea that we're going to rebuild the U.S. industrial base so we can manufacture television sets here is crazy. You know, people are going to be paying $3,000 for a TV rather than $700. So I think 2 years from now, the challenge for the Republicans will be the folks who want to sort of ratchet the clock back. They're not going to be there. In the same way that if I'm a Democrat, I got to figure out how the hell I'm going to capture union workers, not the union organizers, because they're professional Democrats. That's the name of the game. But if you're a steward in a, you know, in a GM plant, assuming GM's still around 3 or 4 years from now, then you're going to wonder, where are your members? Because in this situation, a lot of union workers flip to Trump.
Yeah, I read an interesting study in the last few days where they were doing polling of, do you identify as working class or not? And in this particular study, and I forget the organization that did it, 75% of the people that self-identified as working class also identified as conservative. And there seems to be this kind of rhetorical flip that's happened in the same way that for Republicans, the Republican Party will always be the party of Lincoln. And black people may or may not agree with that, that might be a rhetoric that should have been retired at some point. People's mileage will vary, but it's a kind of hagiography that accompanies the Republican Party. The Democrats believe they are always the party of labor. They are always the working class party, and they're the managerial party. And so there does seem to be this disconnect that's happened there.
Well, they feel that they're the working class party because that's what the people in the cities want to believe they are. The people in the cities, every liberal in the city who wants to unionize their Starbucks and has no concept of how or why a union works, it's just a cool thing that they want to say because they read a few posts on Mother Jones. That's the brand, right? But it doesn't really speak to exactly what that party has been. Now, they certainly still have good relationship with leaderships in unions, but it is what it is. I want to go back to something that you mentioned, though, Heaton, that you are descendant of Barry Goldwater. And I really think that Barry Goldwater is somebody that I've thought a lot about over the last few days, because it's unquestioned now that Donald Trump is the Ronald Reagan of this modern era. And the way that Reagan swept out an entire generation of conservative leadership and installed his own. But part of the reason why I think of Goldwater is that considering where the Republican Party wound up going, which is a lot closer to where Goldwater, when Goldwater ran in 64, he was looked at as an absolute crazy person, and he was marketed as such by the Johnson campaign.
A literal crazy person. That's why we have the Goldwater rule.
Because exactly,
the Psychiatric Association had like 50 people go, oh, yes, I've read several articles that he's said. He's clearly a narcissist.
By the way, I believe published in Truth Magazine, which is the other funny part about that. But it's like he is not remembered in the same way because he got run over by Ronald Reagan in the same way that a generation of people are going to be thought of differently because they got run over by Donald Trump. This is his party. The question is, will the successful Republican politicians look to pick up his coalition? Or will they try to go back into the past and find it? I think on smaller races, House races, you're going to be able to do it. When you're talking about statewide races, this is now Trump's coalition. You're going to have to go to those steak fries. You're going to have to go to those union halls. It ain't going to be all country club anymore. Those days are gone.
Yeah, agree 1,000%. Now, let me ask you the more important question. Is this good for comedy or bad for comedy?
It's not good for my comedy. I will tell you why.
SNL made jokes. SNL made a joke in their cold open. It was an actual joke with a concept, Heaton. I don't know if you saw it.
That's really good. No, I'm glad to hear that. The phenomena that happened during the Trump years that was bad for comedy is that twofold, there were a significant amount of comedians that felt a moral obligation to say, but we need to be serious for a moment, constantly. And on top of that, Trump was, I think, for a very long time, a difficult figure to come up with a comedic angle around, simply because a really good tool within political satire is exaggeration. And if Donald Trump comes out and he's literally using the disembodied skull of Don Rickles as a puppet to make fun of Guam and then throws it away, like we're already starting at an 11 out of 10. I don't know where to take it from here. So that was a functional problem with it. The other problem that was just insufferable and so irritating was there was just a massive amount of clapter that came into the comedy ecosystem during the Trump years where, frankly, a lot of subpar comedians were non-comedians would wander into an open mic and then just give their political hot takes on Trump, and everybody felt obligated to clap for them because they weren't talented enough to get laughs. So there was a lot of that going on. I'll say on my end, I have just began working for Reason, and my plan is to make fun of whoever's in power, as I usually do, and really just make fun of wherever I think I can stash in a joke. There's a decent amount of people that are on the libertarian side of things that really just want to make fun of Democrats. So if I spend my time making fun of Trump because he's the president, from where I'm at, I don't know that it will necessarily be as popular as if Kamala were in power. Like, weirdly, I, as an oppositional figure to a Democrat, will probably be better for my comedy and brand than me being an oppositional figure to a Republican. But that's fairly niche. Overall, though, I think if canary in the coal mine, Justin, if Saturday Night Live no longer thinks that they will abet fascism unless they have a sad woman play piano at the beginning of sketches, that's a good sign.
Yeah, I thought the thing that they did was had the cast come out as themselves and talk about how much they love Donald Trump and they all voted for him just so they could stay off the enemies list. And it's like for a liberal institution, at least it had a concept. Yeah. it had a joke and the punchlines were funny. Like it was slapdash, but I thought it was meaningful, a meaningful step in the right direction. I think that the dark days of comedy where comedic heroes like Stephen Colbert result to puerile and backwards homophobic jokes that would be, you know, something that you would yell at your kid for saying on the playground simply because it hurts old Donnie Trump's feelings are over. And I think that the world is better for it.
I'll add to that just over the last few days, hanging out with lots of people that voted for Kamala Harris and myself, for that matter, my feelings this election are very different than my feelings in 2016. In 2016, I, who was working at Fox Business at the time, was apoplectic that Trump won. Like on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being, oh, I wish I'd got vanilla instead of chocolate, but I couldn't care less. 10 being Emperor Palpatine has destroyed the Senate and we have to go into hiding on Tatooine at this exact moment. I was like a 7 maybe in 2016. And now in 2024, I'm like a 4. I am bothered by this. I don't think it's a good direction for the country, but I'm not frightened. And like again, like and this kind of happened in 2016 where I was very freaked out the night of. And then 2 days later, I started getting messages from my friends where they went, we need to start putting lists together of who can hide our Jewish friends. And I went, one, I don't think we're at the point where we need to worry about the Jews being rounded up. Secondly, if we were, we shouldn't put their name on a list that could be intercepted by authorities. It's just really bad planning on your part.
We'll be back in a couple of minutes with more of our conversation in the Lost Political Middle.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. Consumers spend big on Black Friday. Vivek Pandya with Adobe Lead Insight says there's clearly some momentum going on.
We're seeing a lot of eventized-based spending. We saw good growth over the Prime Day event, over other sales holidays, and that's what we're seeing here in the holiday season.
Lake effect snow is hitting western and upstate New York. Christopher Scanlon is Buffalo's mayor.
The city of Buffalo is prepared for the weather that's moving in, not just today, but for days and weeks leading up to this. We've been preparing for these type of situations.
World Center Kitchen is pausing operations in Gaza after an Israeli drone strike killed three employees. The Israeli military says it was targeting a Hamas militant.
The Israeli army said it had been tracking and then hit an unmarked car with an individual inside who was involved in the Hamas attacks last year without specifying their alleged role.
The BBC's Nick Beek, CBS News Brief.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Bucks host the Wizards. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks host the Washington Wizards tonight in Milwaukee. The Wizards trying to snap a 13-game losing streak. The Bucks held practice after a 3-day break over Thanksgiving. Head coach Doc Rivers.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, they probably ate too much. And, you know, you always, as a coach, we look at days off differently. Like, when I saw the schedule, I said, oh, yeah, we get our 3 days off with Thanksgiving in the middle. You know, I looked at it. I don't know if I looked at it as a positive or not. Giannis had 6 days off. That's a huge stretch for him in the middle of a season or beginning of a season. So that should help his body as well.
College football, the Badgers losing their final game of the season 24-7 at home at Camp Randall Stadium to Minnesota, who reclaimed the Paul Bunyan X. Badgers head coach Luke Fickle on just how flat his team looked.
If you can't be fired up for a rivalry game, if you can't be fired up for a game that's been played since 1890, then I mean, this probably isn't the right place for you.
That's Wisconsin's Luke Fickle. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and a high near 16. Wind chills at 5 to 10 below zero, with a northwest wind that could gust up to 15 miles per hour. For tonight, partly cloudy, low around 9. Partly sunny for Sunday, 24. Mostly cloudy Monday, 24.
Right now, it's 15.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
James Rundy.
I decided to throw off all my wild and crazy short film ways and make a straight up documentary about my uncle. He was one of the small time dairy farmers across the state that were kind of the backbone and why we got our state's name, America's Dairyland.
It was called The Last Milk. Have you ever milked a cow?
Oh yeah.
I'm curious, but I'm scared to do it because I'm worried I might like it.
All right.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
It's the sound of a soda, considered one of the coolest things made in Wisconsin. Jolly Good has been around since the 1960s. Cryer Foods makes it in Random Lake, which is in Sheboygan County. But Cryer started as a canning company in 1913. What was being canned there? Sauerkraut? Peas? Beets? The answer coming up.
At Jolly Good, we believe in quality.
Soda turned into an important revenue stream when production at the canning company slowed in the colder months. So what was being canned there? Sauerkraut, peas, beets? All three, plus juice, soups, and more. By the 1960s, Cryer quit canning and went all in on Jolly Good soda.
For flavor and value, Jolly Good's got it.
The latest resurgence of Jolly Good makes it a slice of Wisconsin for yesterday and today. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot. Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh,
well, that's how the original series was when they moved the camera. Whenever it's the red alert, the
ear. Right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey, folks, if you're just tuning in, I'm Charlie Behrens. This is the Cripes Cast, and here's my conversation with Wisconsin filmmaker Ryland Tews. What I think is cool is that you guys, you know, you did it all, and you did it with the props. Even you brought up your dad made them, and you shot it. You shot in northern Wisconsin, the UP, right? Or where exactly did you shoot it?
Yep, northern Wisconsin, UP. We stayed the first winter. We stayed in Stevenson, Michigan. But we were shooting all over the UP and northern Wisconsin. And then the second winter, we stayed in Manitowish Waters in Wisconsin. And again, we were just shooting all, I mean, you name it, we were shooting something somewhere up there, you know. And of course, you know, once in a while, someone would stop us and we'd be wearing, you know, beaver costumes and they'd think we'd be making some sort of weird furry sex video, which I assure you, we were not, but it was definitely a strange thing to stumble upon.
I hope you guys steered clear of any public hunting land, by the way, because, you know, or do you have to have orange hats on? How did you protect your beavers? Because there's a lot of hunters that might listen first, shoot second, you know what I mean? Or shoot first, second.
Oh yeah, no, we definitely thought about that, but we were, we never saw any hunters, unfortunately.
Yeah.
That would have been a good story if someone got shot, but unfortunately no one shot on set.
Yeah. Next time you should really do that for the press. I mean, if you want, you know, think about all the more money you could have made if you had. I'm not talking a lethal shot. I'm talking just a flesh wound, like a little calf nick, you know?
Just think if like I got shot in the ass or something, like that's just comedy right there.
Right.
You
know? Right. Yeah. We're not trying to recreate the rust situation or anything.
Yeah, no, I'd get shot in the ass and I'd think at first, yeah, it's really painful. But I think about 30 seconds later, I'd think, this is pretty funny. This is good.
Nothing beats a shot in the ass. I mean, as far as physical comedy goes, that's kind of best, you know?
Yeah, we'll save that gimmick for the sequel, 200s of Beats.
Did you just tell me what the third movie is?
No, I did not.
No, that'd be a shame. That is a shame because that would be great, is what I was trying to say.
Maybe one day. I mean, it's not the first one in the pipeline, but you never know. You never know.
What did you shoot it on?
Oh my God, it was like a Panasonic GH5. I think that's what it was.
GH5. What even is that?
It's just like a consumer, like it's a nice camera for what we needed, like, but it's not like a shooting on Alexa.
Yeah. It's just one of those standard DSLR deals. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It's but that's the thing is like, we didn't need to even the movie's not even shot in 4K or even 2K. The movie shot in 1080 because even if we were to have shot it in 4K with like a nice Alexa, which would have been a waste of money, we would have just degraded the movie anyways, because that's the look of the movie. We have to make the movie look grainy and scratchy in order to do all these effect shots, you know, because the movie doesn't look like, it's not Avatar, you know?
Right.
It's like, what's the point of shooting on at a super expensive camera if you're going to degrade the quality anyway? So we got the GH5. I don't know how much it cost. It was like $1,000. It's probably less now, but that's all we needed.
That's, and because also in editing it, if you're editing 4K, that's just going to bog down the edit of it all too.
Yes. Yes. And Mike would have the, he actually had his Mac in the cabin we were staying at. So every day after shooting, he would bring the footage into the edit immediately and show us like, see,
yeah,
that's how we shot that thing today. And we'd go, okay, I guess we'll stick around for another day.
How long did it take to shoot it?
It took, I think it was 13 weeks.
Wow.
And it was over two winters. It was winter 2020 and winter 2021. And then we had some other shoots here and there throughout the course of the year. But I'd say in total about 13 weeks.
Wow, dude. I mean, you know, in my world, it's like you shoot something, you put it up like the next week or whatever, and you get that, maybe that dopamine hit because it did well, or you get that sort of rejection if it didn't do well, and then you kind of change from there. So that's kind of the world that I'm in, and I feel like a lot of people making content at all are in. But for you guys to invest that much time in such a unique vision, I mean, that's got to be half the battle right there, is staying with something and believing in it for so long, because it's just not that, that's not what I guess, that's the movie business for sure. But so much of the entertainment business is going away from movies. And it's just really cool to like see what something with that much thought and that much execution can, what can happen. I mean, what you guys create is a, it's a masterpiece. It's really, really great.
Well, thank you. That's very, very kind of you to say, and I appreciate that. And like you said, that's what it was. It was just like, we had to, you know, the director, Mike Cheslick, he said early on, he said, look guys, we either make this movie or we die. There's no third option. So we have to make the movie or we will die. So even though the movie took a very long time, you know, we started shooting in the beginning of January 2020, and the movie wasn't actually finished until September 2022. It was all worth it because we knew, because we were allotted a bunch of time, we were able to make the exact movie we wanted to. There's a lot of indie films these days who, you know, they say, oh, we shot our whole feature in 21 days. And it's like, ah, okay, well, that's great. That's a great turnaround. I'm happy for your turnaround and that like you, oh, wow, boom, you made a movie. But like, because our movie took so long, we were able to just get it absolutely correct and jam as much stuff into it as possible and make exactly the kind of movie we wanted to. So I guess at the end of the day, even though the movie took a super long time to make and we had to do so many different shoots and go up north twice, you know, two winters, it was all worth it because at the, you know, now the rest of our lives, we can look back and say, you know, we didn't compromise. We made the exact movie we wanted to, and it turned out to be the right move.
And was it always a plan to shoot it over two winters?
No. I mean, originally we were like, oh yeah, we can shoot this all like in one winter. And it just became apparent so quick that was just not going to happen. First of all, we only had a little bit of money the first winter. And it wasn't after we showed some other future investors like what we'd already shot that then they came aboard. But no, the thing is, we had such a small crew of guys. I mean, sometimes it'd be like two to like four or five guys, and everything moves so much slower when you're in the deep snow in the cold in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, lugging all that equipment and all the props and all the costumes into like the woods, and you're cold and you're stepping and it's like you're getting buried in snow. It's just, it's so much manual labor that by the time you actually start to shoot, you've already like wasted so much time. And then, oh, all of a sudden the sun's going down because it's 4 p.m.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You have way less day from a practicality standpoint. This is, this is it's a difficult task. Did you have money to pay people like right away, or was it like deferred payment? Like, kind of geeking out in the nuts and bolts in this, but I think it's cool to like dive into that for other people out there who are inspired by your film, want to make their film. Like, how do you do that practically?
I mean, we paid guys as much as we could. I'll say that, you know, and again, no one was getting rich shooting this movie, you know.
Right.
We're not rich now either, but
yeah,
it's not like, again, there was no stars in this movie or anything, but you know, we paid what we could. Again, it was a small budget movie. But a lot of it was done out of the kindness of people's hearts because they just thought it was a lot of fun to shoot the movie. I mean, like, you know, I would go through my phone and I would think to myself, like, okay, who am I going to get to come up for a few days or a week to help us out, shoot this movie? And you just start thinking, okay, like, this is a good dude. This is a good dude. This is a good dude. And you say, hey, you want to come up for a weekend? You want to come up for a week and just like play a beaver in our, you know, stupid mascot movie? And they just be like, oh yeah, for sure, yeah, how can I help, you know? Because it's not every day you get a phone call saying, hey, we need you to come play a mascot, yeah, you know, a feature film, and you know, you're gonna be, you know, you're gonna be one of the stars of the movie, and hey, we got a fridge full of beer for you too, you know. Yeah. Every day it's always a hard out, you know, when you can only film to like 4 or 4:30 every day. Everyone's going to get home to the cabin. We're going to drink 30 beers or whatever. Right. And we're going to get up early. We're going to do it all over again. And so there was never any sort of like interpersonal conflicts or anything. It was just a bunch of dudes in the woods making a furry video.
Yeah. That's perfect. So it was a good time. Do you guys have, like when you finally got the cut ready and everything, did you have sort of a feeling then that it was going to take off in the way it did? Or
yeah, I mean, I was always very confident in the movie. I will say, I always thought we had something pretty special on our hands. But again, it went through a lot of, it's just, you know, Mike, he edited the whole movie, and he did all the VFX work on the movie as well. So he was constantly doing like new cuts of scenes and final cuts of the movie and stuff like that. But by the time it was all in place, I just had this feeling like it was going to really resonate with people. And again, it took a while because no dialogue, black and white. It's an hour and 45 minutes. There's no stars. You know, it's a little hard to convince people, like film festivals and stuff, like, hey, your audience is going to like this. And then once the reviews started coming in and other festivals were like, hey, you know, I hear this movie's pretty good. And oh, these guys are going to show up with a big raccoon hat and they're going to wrestle beavers, you know, then it was sort of an all-encompassing like event. And then we really knew like we had something kind of special here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, that is super fun. So what's your story? Where did you grow up and what got you into film?
Well, I grew up in Milwaukee. And I've just been kind of, you know, I don't know, making home movies and stuff from a young age. Whenever there was a class project, in elementary school or high school, I always asked the teacher, hey, can I make a video? You know? Yeah. And so the videos were never very related to the, you know, the
assignment.
The they were just impressed that, oh, they made a little movie. I guess I'll give them a good grade, you know? Yeah. But yeah, just from a young age doing that. And then Mike Cheslick and I met in high school. And then our first video together was a promotional video for the high school, for Whitefish Bay High School. Just called the Whitefish Bay High School promo. You can look it up on YouTube. That was our first one. And then we did a history video also for Whitefish Bay High School. And people seemed to really like our videos. They thought they were very fun and funny and silly. And they said, good job, guys. Here's a check for $100. And then we said, hey, we should just, you know, keep working together. I guess people seem to think we're decently talented. So even though Mike went off to NYU out east and I went to UW Milwaukee for film school, we continued to work together, and I would like fly out to New York and we'd work on stuff together. And then eventually we made this web series together called LIPS, which is an acronym for League of Interplanetary Process Servers. And at first we thought that was going to take off, but nothing came of it. And so I just started making Lake Michigan Monster back in Milwaukee. I started sending Mike footage. He started editing it. And next thing you know, Lake Michigan Monster is sort of a little cult hit. And then we were able to get a little bit more money for beavers. And that's where we are today.
That's cool. So did you like sort of growing up, did you like the path for movies? There used to be like this path to do movies. And now with sort of COVID and sort of people going to movies or not going to movies or watching them at home or whatever, the whole industry is completely changing, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, is this sort of the path to do it in your mind, if just making your own stuff as opposed to, you know, the traditional go to LA, work as a bartender, work as a server, audition, that kind of thing? Did you ever in your mind think about going that route, or have you always been doing sort of what you want to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, like I, you know, Mike lives out in LA and has for several years. I mean, I lived in LA for a few years when we were finishing Lake Michigan Monster. And I just worked at like a ramen shop, which, by the way, my love interest in beavers, the furrier, we worked at the same ramen shop together.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Really?
And, yeah, we were just like friends. And like then eventually I told her we were making this beaver movie. And I said, hey, do you want to like be this character? And she said, sure. So
that's awesome. Yeah, she's got a following outside of the thing too. Doesn't she? She's got a YouTube following and whatever, doesn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she's got a huge following. She has like 500,000 subscribers. Yeah. Everyone should check out Olivia Graves at The Witch of Wonderlust on YouTube. And I don't know. I just thought, oh, she'd be great for this part. So boom, there you go. And she didn't even have any like acting experience, but she does a great job.
Oh, she did awesome. Yeah. So you did that traditional thing then. You went out there and like,
But like we did Lake Michigan Monster, and then I kind of was, we finished Lake Michigan Monster once I got out to LA, and then we were like trying to like sell Lake Michigan Monster and stuff. And, but like, honestly, usually when you go to LA, then you're like, oh, you're like trying to do all these like tryouts and stuff and audition for all these different parts. I didn't do that because I was so focused on me and Mike's next movie. And it's one of those things where it's like, I much rather spend all my time and energy like in our next movie rather than splitting time trying to like do other projects, because I knew beavers was going to be such a gigantic undertaking that it had to require all my, you know, focus and energy. So it was a little, I mean, obviously it helped to move out there so Mike and I could work closer together. I mean, if we're working partners, we should probably live in the same city, you know? So that made sense, but I didn't do one tryout or audition for any other movie in LA because I was just too focused on finishing Lake Michigan Monster and then just going right into beavers, you know?
Yeah.
And then eventually once COVID happened, that was kind of the final straw where it's like, what the hell am I doing in LA?
Right.
So I went back to Milwaukee, Mike stayed in LA, but then, yeah, we raised some money and we decided to make beavers up in northern Wisconsin because we had connections in Wisconsin and we knew people around Wisconsin and Minnesota and stuff. So it was kind of funny for Mike then, because he was like the LA guy in Hollywood. And he's like, now I have to come back to Wisconsin in the northern woods and make this movie, you know? So nothing about it's very traditional, but I would say that if you want to make your own indie movie, obviously you should, because you get to make exactly what you want, but just don't try to make it a Hollywood movie, because you're probably not going to have very much money. So don't try to make a Hollywood movie, try to make something completely different. And that's what we did with both of our movies. We couldn't get some like great 4K color image, so we made it look like this grainy black and white, it just looks like crap, but that allowed us to do like 1500 effect shots and beavers or whatever. And then on top of that, you just got to set aside money for marketing, because the nice thing about Beavers was we got in cahoots with SRH in Milwaukee, this ad agency there. And after Beavers was finished, because it was an SRH co-production, they kind of footed the bill on all the marketing, and they really did, all the marketing on the Instagram accounts and the Facebook and X and stuff. And they did all these amazing Beavers posts, like a few every week, and people loved them, like doing all like the Beavers, like movie parody posts and stuff like that. So I would say, even though you should make your own indie movie, make sure you set aside money or become friends with a marketing agency.
Especially
because everyone's on their phone these days, just staring at Instagram or whatever. And it's like, you got to get on there, you got to do some sort of viral marketing of some sort. So.
And then what is the importance to you of film versus whatever we're doing on social media these days? Like what does that mean to you? And why do you think that's important and worth hanging on to as people gravitate more towards smaller screen?
I just think that there's such a power in cinema that is unmatched by any other medium. Obviously there are some terrific television shows too, but like there's something when you're like sitting in a theater full of people. That's why I'm a big advocate of theaters too. When you're sitting in a theater full of people seeing a great movie and you have this like collective experience seeing something for the first time, it's just a very powerful thing. And it's something that took a long time to make too. So hopefully you're kind of guaranteed to have a worthwhile experience too. I think that's kind of the main thing for me is seeing something that you've created and put all your blood, sweat, and tears in over a long time, and seeing it projected on the big screen and seeing just all the joy it brings people is really quite powerful. And there's nothing quite like it.
That's great, man. Yeah, I would agree with that. We've got a segment on this podcast called What Makes You Say Cripes. So I don't think I got to explain the meaning of cripes to you. So what makes you say cripes?
It's got to be warm beer.
warm beer is the worst. I'll say this, though. There are some places in Germany where they serve it warm intentionally. Can you believe that?
That's what they keep telling me. But like, I've had plenty of warm beer in my day. I've had plenty of hot beer that's been sitting in the sand at a beach before. And it is, I don't understand. Like, I understand like they drink warm beer. Like, I understand in like England, it rains a lot. It's very overcast. But like, even if I'm sitting by a fire and I'm cold, still give me an ice cold beer. Like, we were out shooting hundreds of beavers, it's below zero. And then we get home and we have like ice cold Bush Light, right. I can't stand a warm beer.
Well, that's all the time we have for now. If you want to listen to my full conversation with Ryland, check out the Cripes Cast anywhere you get your podcasts.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down, just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin Jubilee.
Sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Up North News Radio.
Jane Mattenair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Matt Rothschild is going to be sitting in the big chair to break down all the news with analysis and humor. Don't miss it.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
When severe weather hits and the power goes out, do you have a plan? For reliable power and peace of mind, propane can do that. It only takes about 10 seconds for a propane-powered generator to restore power to your home. So no matter what Mother Nature has in store, you know you're prepared. Learn more at WIPGA.org. This message is sponsored by your local propane provider and the Wisconsin Propane Education and Research Council.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.